Welcome to the Veterans for Peace Radio Hour and Podcast on Radio Free Nashville, 107.1 and 103.7, and streaming live at radiofreenashville.org.
Our actions today and what we do now can have an impact by the end of the century. I just think that's very, very important. I mean, typically people want to work in their own self-interest about me and mine at the immediate moment. But it's a time in history when we really have to consider how our children and grandchildren and their children are going to survive in the future.
That was Cindy Peister, founding member on the steering committee of the Veterans for Peace Climate Crisis and Militarism Project and a member of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, otherwise known as WILF. And you will hear more from Cindy and her colleague, Dr. Omar Clay, about the climate, militarism, and COP28. But first, my name is Jim Wolgamuth, and I'm here with fellow Vietnam veteran Harvey Bennett. We are members of Veterans for Peace. Veterans for Peace is an international organization of military veterans and allies whose collective efforts are to build a culture of peace, humanity, equality, and justice. Just go to veteransforpeace.org. This radio show and podcast is on stations across the country thanks to the Pacifica Radio Network. We're also on SoundCloud, Anchor Podcast, Spotify, and your phone podcast app. Just search Veterans for Peace. The Veterans for Peace Radio Hour and Radio Free Nashville are supported in part by you, the listener, because it is you that keeps Radio Free Nashville going. And as a result, this radio show is then picked up by the Pacifica Radio Network, so we're heard across the country. So if you think this is important, just go to radiofreenashville.org and click on the donate button and keep Harvey and I on the air in every time zone in the U.S. And if you think the work of Veterans for Peace is important, just go to the veteransforpeace.org website and click on the donate button there. We'd really appreciate it. So today we're going to revisit a discussion on climate and militarism that we had last year about the Conference of Parties, known as COP. And last year we talked about COP27, and again we will call on Cindy Peister, and this time colleague Dr. Omar Clay joins us to discuss COP28 and much more. Now, Dr. Clay is a physicist and a science educator. His research work spans from studies on nuclear quantum mechanics to global security, water poverty, and environmental health. Dr. Clay has been promoting science literacy and speaking on environmental and climate change challenges for the last 2 decades. Cindy is a lifetime activist with a long history of peace, human rights, and justice work. She was a cable access television producer and host for 6 years during the Iraq War and writer-producer of U.S. War Crimes documentary. She is a lifetime associate member of Veterans for Peace. She's also former chair and founding member of Veterans for a Just Palestine. She has worked on the impact of militarism and war on the climate. She is founding member on the steering committee of Veterans for Peace Climate Crisis and Militarism Project. She's also a member of the International Convocation of UU Women, ICUUW, UN Advocacy. And as I mentioned, she's also a member of Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. She's been a WILF delegate to COP27 in Egypt, and this year a badged virtual participant in COP28 held in the UAE. She has written for Peace and Planet News and other outlets and has spoken about militarism, military emissions, and COP27 internationally. So, Cindy, we had you on the show last year to discuss last year's COP. Can you set the scene for this year's COP?
Yeah, you know, before we do get going, though, I just want to thank you, Jim and Harvey, and the listeners here at VFP Radio Hour because of all you do. I mean, I just appreciate your work so much, and I think it really means a lot in terms of promoting democracy around the country, because people are deprived of the information they need to make good decisions in a democracy. So thank you for that. So, you know, I mean, I've just been a lifetime activist, and I really wanted to go to COP27. I sought that out. And the reason was, is I had been working already for a few years on the issue of the impacts of militarism and war on climate. And it just seemed like the next step. And I was really lucky. The Women's International League for Peace and Freedom sent me there as an NGO delegate for them. And this year I went as a badged virtual participant, and I was really lucky for that too. Being able to participate virtually was just very, very valuable. I really wanted to start the talk on the science so that people to understand why it's so urgent. So I just would love it if Omar just went ahead.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you, Harvey. Thank you, Cindy, for coming together here for this really critical dialogue. I want to thank the BFP Radio Hour and also all the listeners who are tuning in to listen to a conversation that I think is really critical about the state of the climate today and then about what we might do about it in the future. I've been a science educator and been talking about climate science for almost two decades now. And what's happened in the last decade, I mean, what's happened in the last year, actually, has got me more alarmed than I've been in a long time. So I want to share with you guys some of the new science in climate change. And I guess, you know, to start with, it's probably worth it to just set up what climate change is about, how it comes about. I know we've all been living in an era of climate change for a long time now, but sometimes people have some really basic misconceptions that, you know, we're on a 4.5 billion year old planet. The climate's been changing off and on in a number of different ways for a long time, and it's changing now. Why does the climate ever change? And the reason the climate changes is because there's an energy imbalance in the planet. The planet has an energy budget. We receive energy from the sun, solar radiation comes into the planet, and then we lose energy due to thermal emissions from the surface and the atmosphere of the planet because Earth is warmer than it surrounds. So just like if you had infrared goggles and you could see somebody at night, the reason you could see them is because they're emitting more thermal emissions than the surround. And that's the same way the Earth cools off. The reason we ever have climate change on Earth is because of an energy imbalance. Now, if you look over geologic history, and we have a pretty good record of paleoclimate, that is how the climate's changed throughout the history of our planet. In fact, that's actually what got scientists interested in climate change in the very beginning, back in the 1800s. Because they saw this evidence in the geologic record of ice ages, and how did this stuff come about? Why was it so cold here when it's warm now? And so the way we just on the side, the way we were able to tell what the paleoclimate is that we capture, do a chemical and an isotopic analysis of bubbles of air that are captured in ice cores from Greenland and Antarctica. That allows us to see what the temperatures were and what the atmospheric concentrations of different compounds were about a million years back. And then we also, there's sediment cores that allow us to further that analysis even further back in time. And so we know that Earth has had major changes in climate in the past. And for the most part, those changes in climate had to do with, again, this energy balance. There's some subtle variations in the way the eccentricity of Earth's orbit around the sun moves. And there's some variations in the tilt of Earth's rotational axis. The eccentricity changes are on the order of about 100,000 years. The changes in our rotational axis, which is called obliquity, is about 41,000 years. And I have my students do this regularly, is they'll go back over the paleoclimate record and they just compare it to these cycles, the elliptical eccentricity cycle and the rotational cycle. And it's remarkable how well we are able to match those things up and say, wow, this is really clearly from this form of energy imbalance. Mm. But as you can tell, 21, 41, 100,000 year timescales, that's not going to account for the climate change we're seeing today. We're seeing today something very different. This has to do with the fact that we're releasing less energy to space, and that's because we've radically changed the chemical composition of our atmosphere by burning a lot of fossil fuels. And so people are familiar with this. And since the 1800s, we've seen CO2 levels in the atmosphere, global atmosphere, go up by 50%, methane by about 160%, nitrous oxide by about 23%. So these are huge increases in the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And what that does, and they're called greenhouse gases for a reason, obviously, because they're trapping heat. They absorb some of that thermal emissions that would normally cool our planet. Now they're not. And for the last decade, everybody here has probably seen the headlines here and there. You know, it's the hottest year on record. Or it's, you know, so what has actually happened over the last decade is now we have the hottest decade on record. Mm. It looks like 2023 will be the hottest year on record. Now, record goes back to 1850 if you look at direct temperature measurements. So hottest year on record, that means a lot. But actually with this paleoclimatic data, we can go back a lot further. It looks like that the last decade and last year were probably the hottest in about 100,000 years. Mm. So that is pretty sobering, when you really try to think about, like the history of our species on this planet, for instance. And you might wonder, okay, well, why is that? And of course, it comes back to this energy imbalance. And this is some of the new data that I personally find just really alarming. And that is that, and we're able to measure the energy imbalance very carefully thanks to NASA satellites in atmosphere, which are monitoring the solar incident solar radiation, so energy coming in from the sun, but also the energy reflected from our sand, our planet. Radiation that didn't make it, wasn't absorbed, and then also energy that's emitted thermally. And what we see, what those NASA satellites see, and I should plug NASA here, this is something that as citizens we really need to maintain these programs. It doesn't take much to cut them, and if we don't have the data, we are in even bigger trouble. We're going to be flying blind. What this data shows, though, is that we have seen almost a doubling in the energy imbalance since 2005. That's a big deal. That energy imbalance is measured in terms of watts per square meter. And it's an energy imbalance that we're measuring now is 1 watt per square meter compared to the 2005, 2010 data. So 1 watt per square meter, that maybe doesn't mean a lot to people. What is a watt? Maybe those of us that have been around long enough, maybe remember a 60 watt light bulb that could light your room. So a watt doesn't sound like a lot of energy, but it's per square meter. A meter is about 3 feet. So 1 watt for every 3 square feet on the planet. Again, maybe that doesn't feel like a lot, but when you realize there's 510 billion square meters on the planet, you realize, well, that's a lot of energy. And so there's two different ways that I'd like to present that amount of energy. One of them is just in terms of what we've seen with the greenhouse gas concentration. That 1 watt difference that we're seeing in the last decade is about equivalent to a 20-year increase in greenhouse gases that we've seen. It's a huge amount. In terms of something maybe that's more palpable for people, the Hiroshima atomic bombs, about 16 kilotons. It's a little bit of a rough estimate, really. But maybe 10 to the 14 joules of energy was released in that explosion. If you just do the math, and it's not really that difficult, the extra watt of per square meter that we're seeing today is about 440,000 Hiroshima bombs per day, extra energy from our 2005, 2010 data. So that's a lot of
Could you
extra.
say that again? Could you just say
Yeah,
that
absolutely.
again?
Yeah, 440,000 Hiroshima bombs every day on our planet compared to 10, 15 years ago. So this isn't even compared to the pre-industrial baseline or anything like that. This is our current period of warming compared to what we've been seeing. So this is what has me particularly alarmed. I think a lot of climate scientists are very alarmed about this. So a lot of energy, most of that energy goes into the ocean, about 90% of it. So we don't get to feel and see it just with our everyday, but it's there and it's coming, it's going to come home. So that's one of the bits of new data that is very concerning. What are we going to see with that data? Well, of course, we're going to see this warming. We already see the warming's increasing. That's not news to us. We've been studying climate change. Everybody here is worried about climate change. The climate has been changing. Global has been the globe has been warming. So it's another hot year. But what we're seeing is an acceleration of the rate of warming. So that's what's really happened in this last decade is from 1970 to 2010, we were seeing a warming rate of about 0.18 degrees Celsius per decade.
Is it time to change the terminology? Climate change just sounds so bland.
One of the things that we're always worried about when we're at least as a science educator, is that we're going to make people feel like, oh, well, I guess I can't do anything about it,
Yeah,
and I'm just
right.
going to go
It's
crawl in my
you
hole
don't want it to be.
and burn some more coal or something,
Right. Yeah.
And so you don't want to do that. It's funny. I had students once tell me they knew climate change was false. This was years ago because they changed it from global warming. It used to be global warming, and now it's climate change, and that shows that we were trying to lie or something. I never quite understood the logic, but I'm just going to work with the words. But I think
I have heard global heating lately, which I think is might be more accurate.
You're right. That is more accurate because so much of the heat is being convected into the depths of the ocean, and then we're not feeling it as warmth. And only that, here we're living in our home, our little lifestyles, and a lot of us are using heat in the winter and stuff, and we don't feel warm. So I wouldn't mind a little extra degree of heat here or there. But in fact, that actually really gets to the point here is so we've seen this acceleration in global warming from 0.18 degrees Celsius per decade to now 0.27 degrees of Celsius per decade. That's in the last 10 years. And so we've been seeing this happen. The reason this is news from a climate perspective, I guess, comes back to what it means when we talk about climate change, is climate is typically weather averaged over 10 years. So if you have a hot year or a cold year, you can't really say that's climate change in and of itself. You really want to see that average, that decadal average at minimum. And so we now have that. It's a decadal average. The acceleration is clear here in 2023. We're just closing out 2023. The average temperature, and there'll be some adjustments here, but looks to be about 1.46 degrees Celsius last year, 1.46 degrees Celsius. Now that might remind some people of that whole Paris Climate Accords thing, right? 2015, we were really, our objective, supposedly, as an international community, was to maintain our temperature below 1.5 degrees Celsius. Mm-hmm. And we're not going to do that. That's pretty much a guarantee at this point. 1.5, and to put that in terms of Fahrenheit, that's 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit. So, you know, to get to Harvey's point about global warming, global heating, and, you know, is it time for another change? What does 1.5 degrees Celsius mean for our planet? And I think a lot of people hear these numbers, 1 watt per square meter, 1.5 degrees Celsius, just doesn't sound very impressive. But when you're talking on a planetary scale, it is. But our planet is, you know, there's an ecosphere, a very thin biofilm that is on the crust of our planet that is living. And so we should put this in living terms. If you had a temperature, a body temperature where it was elevated by 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit, you've got a temperature of 101.3. So, you know, that's a fever. It's not a very high fever, but it's a fever. And if you had that for several days or several weeks, you would definitely want to go get some medical help. So this is not a small thing. This is our living planet that has this fever. Along with the accelerated rate of temperature increase, we're seeing an acceleration in sea level rise. So it's now more than twice the rate that it was in the 1990s through 2000. We've seen a tremendous decrease in Antarctic sea ice. The Antarctic sea ice in 2023 was a historic low, 1,000 kilometers, square kilometers less than our previous record low. That's a lot of lost sea ice. And who cares about sea ice? Okay, maybe, you know, and they don't even have polar bears in Antarctica. Maybe nobody cares. But this is a really big deal for our climate system because sea ice reflects almost all of the light that's incident on, about 70% anyway, of the solar radiation incident on sea ice reflects off. When that ice melts and leaves ocean underneath it, that absorbs about 70% of the solar radiation incident on it. And so this is a global warming created phenomenon that itself drives global warming, right? And so that is a feedback loop, a positive feedback loop. It's one of the, you know, potential tipping points and problems that we are facing as we move forward. And then I guess, you know, there's a lot I'd love to share with you guys about the new data, but most of the rest of the new data actually comes from paleoclimatic data from our ancient history. And so why would anybody here care about that today? And the reason is because it's really caused us to rethink some of our climate models. And those climate models are what we use to make projections of the future. And so, you know, Dr. Hansen, James Hansen, one of the leading climate researchers, most people have heard this man's name, and he has put out a couple different papers, but one worth mentioning is Global Warming in the Pipeline 2023. And it's a doozy. And he covers a tremendous range of subjects in it. One of the big parts of that paper, I guess, really is his projections, what he expects to happen as a result of the models being changed in light of new paleoclimatic data. And so just to give people a sense of how important models are in science, I want to remind everybody, in 1845, the planet Neptune was predicted based on Newton's law of gravity. We hadn't been able to observe it. It was so dark. In 1869, we predicted several different elements, boron, aluminum, magnesium, that was Mendeleev, because he put together the periodic table and it had spaces that we just didn't understand there were elements yet. We hadn't discovered it, hadn't been able to isolate them yet. In 1896, Savant Arrhenius made the first projections of how much carbon could increase global warming. He came up with a climate sensitivity of 5, and we'll come back to what climate sensitivity means in the context of current models. In 1929, the Dirac equation, where we took quantum mechanics, Dirac did, he took quantum mechanics and made it mesh with special relativity. He predicted antimatter, That's a concept that nobody had even conceived of before, and we discovered it within a few years. So I'm not saying that our current global climate models are that impressive, but we have been using models within the context of science for a very long time. This is
and they've
what,
worked.
And they have made extraordinarily successful predictions. I might also point out that in 1981, that was the first model of global climate change that I'm aware of that James Hansen wrote. And that model is still producing. I mean, you can use it today, and it does a pretty good job of telling us where our temperatures are today. A very simple model compared to our climate models today. But nonetheless, I was only 11 years old at that time, and that model is still able to do a pretty good job of telling us what our temperatures are today. So that gives you a sense of how potent and models can be. What's happened in the paleoclimate data is that they've got a more accurate temperature record of what happened in the last glacial maximum. And that's because they've realized that some of the biological data that they were using before was actually corrupting their deductions. And so what it looks like is that the last glacial maximum was a lot colder than we thought it was. And that what that means is that the planet's sensitivity to greenhouse gases is much higher than we had thought it was. Now, all of these models have had a climate sensitivity, and I say all of them, that's overgeneralization. The average climate sensitivity of the models that we've been using pretty much since Hansen's in 1981 has been around a climate sensitivity of about 3 degrees Celsius per double CO2 level. So a climate sensitivity, what it means in terms of a model is how much the global average temperature will increase if the CO2 levels were to double. So that's just the measure they use. And it's typically the IPCC models have had a modal average of around 3 degrees Celsius per doubling of CO2 for many years. Those models are very successful, incidentally. They have done a great job, just like Hansen's job is. Hansen's models have done a great job. But his new paper says that climate sensitivity based on this new paleoclimate data is about 4.8 degrees Celsius. So 4.8 degrees Celsius versus 3 degrees Celsius is a big deal. That's a big deal. We're already halfway to doubling CO2 since pre-industrial levels. So that's a difference between 1.8 degrees Celsius in about 2.5 decades, probably. So that's a big deal. And you might immediately say, well, okay, you know, you said the models were accurate. Now you're telling me the climate sensitivity is way off. How can these two things be true? And the way that they're both true is that we haven't just been underestimating how sensitive the Earth climate system is to greenhouse gases. We've also been underestimating how sensitive it is to the other stuff that we're putting in the atmosphere. So every time we burn this a hydrocarbon or a fossil fuel, we're creating all kinds of other air pollutants as well. So we create nitrous oxide, we create sometimes methane, we create sulfur dioxide, particulate matter, and these other, they're all hazardous to human health, all of them, carbon monoxide included. And at this point on our planet, recent estimates from the environmental community are saying about 95% of the world's population lives in an area where it has unhealthy air. As early as 2012, the World Health Organization was saying air is officially considered a carcinogen. So we've seen a lot of air pollution being emitted coincidentally with these greenhouse gases. And the thing is that some of these air pollutants, the sulfur dioxides, the nitrogen dioxides, and the particulate matter act as little mirrors. They reflect radiation back out towards the sun. More than that, they also act as condensation centers. They're for the formation of a cloud. So clouds form around these things. It's a real positive aspect of the environmental community and some of our government actions to control and regulate air pollution. And we do need to do that. It's a big deal. But what happened in 2015 is that the Maritime Institute Organization finally reduced sulfur content in shipping fuels to the point that sulfur dioxide emissions were so greatly reduced that the clouds that typically would form behind them, the cloud trails, are dissipating, and now there's less energy being reflected back. So we are now absorbing more solar radiation, and this is what those numbers about the energy imbalance are really measuring. So they're saying, look, yay, you controlled your particulate pollution. Unfortunately, what that means is that the energy is the Earth is now absorbing energy that once was radiating. And so and Hansen's model, I got to cover him a little bit on this, and that is that these models, there's generations of them. And the IPCC's last generation of models, the CMIP-6 comparison project, many models had a much higher climate sensitivity than the previous models, because they're trying to, or at least in part, because they're trying to accurately include cloud cover. So that means that we've got this very sensitive climate system, and if we control our particulate emissions, and we want to do that, that we're likely to see some of that global warming that's in the pipeline. And that is the other side of the paleoclimate data that's really important, is that when we look at these previous interglacial periods, we find that they had much more drastic sea level rise and fall than would be accountable for with our current models of ocean mixing. So it suggests that ocean mixing is not as well mixed as we thought, which means that ice sheets, especially the West Antarctic ice sheet, the Thwaites ice shelf there, are going to melt much more rapidly than anticipated if that paleoclimate data does port over. And so according to Hansen's new model, what we're going to see is, and Hansen's not alone with the 1940, with the 2045 prediction of 2 degrees Celsius, but his models are predicting that we'll probably lose the West Antarctic ice sheet, probably by the end of the century, but if not by the end of the century, earlier, and that we'll probably see a shutdown of AMOC, which is the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Current. This is that massive ocean current that is moving warmer tropical waters towards the poles and moderating climate throughout the planet. So if that thing shuts down, it really impacts the climate around the world, but it also impacts the ocean biome, because it also is mixing nutrients from deep the polar ice, bringing that the nutrient rich ice to the tropics, and then bringing that warm tropical water up there.
Is that the same thing as the Gulf Stream, or is that just a?
The Gulf Stream's a little different, but there's interaction between all these currents, and actually the Gulf Stream is potentially on the chopping block. That's probably about 3 degrees Celsius is the Gulf Stream may shut down.
Is that what you just talked about, the current that runs up the Atlantic?
Yes. So it's a thermohaline circuit, or global conveyor belt is another phrase that they use for it. So AMOC is another one. So there's several different terms for this, but that looks like that's potentially threatened, but certainly by 2080 at our current rate. So these are really pretty dire predictions from a climate perspective, and they're more dire than anything that I've seen recently.
Because if that current shuts down, then that changes the whole economy of the UK.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Oh, it'll be a lot colder in Northern Europe, actually. Mm. Yeah.
That was Dr. Omar Clay. I guess we'll turn it back over to Cindy to see what her efforts were to try and derail all these models. So here is Cindy Peister, member of Veterans for Peace and co-founder of the Climate and Militarism Project within Veterans for Peace.
Well, I think what Omar has just contributed here is really serious. I mean, the whole concept of COP was based originally on the science. They put the COP, the United Nations Framework Climate Convention on Climate Change, and the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change together in response to what we were hearing from our scientists here about climate back in, 1989, when James Hansen testified in front of Congress. And that has been the core basis of the whole get together every year to try to deal with these things. It's not news to anybody that year after year after year, except for maybe the Paris Accords and a few of the other gatherings, that for the most part, COP has been kind of flopping. We haven't gotten what we need from them. One thing that I'd like to share with you here is about the insights into how that all works. We all have to understand how COP actually functions so that we can confront them, deal with it, and get this thing up and going. But before I go to that, I want to make another comment about the science that Omar has just talked to us about. So in terms of a rapid pace of advancing, raising temperatures here on Earth, I think people need to understand that if we do get to the 1.5 relatively soon, if that happens, that our actions today and what we do now can have an impact by the end of the century. I just think that's very, very important. I mean, typically people want to work in their own self-interest about me and mine at the immediate moment, but it's a time in history when we really have to consider how our children and grandchildren and their children are going to survive in the future. So anyway, I want to talk about one of the positives about COP is really incredible. And that is, I mean, this year there were 100,000 people from around the world. I was blown away on COP27 when there were 50,000. It doubled in 1 year in terms of people that were showing up for this. And the dynamics of the people that are representing the NGOs, the delegates like myself, and many of the figures from the world's governments are just absolutely doing everything that they can to try to fix things. And one of the things that people do at COP is they set up what's called side events. And this year, there were 300 or more side events every single day. And the side events are opportunities for people from around the world to share what they've learned, what they've researched, what they know to advance our work. And they cover every aspect of climate change. So we're talking about wastewater treatment. We're talking about what's going on in the forest, the mountains, the ocean, the cloud cover, the science, every minute finance. Some of these situations are big, some are small, some are covering what's going on in particular climate areas like the Sahel or different parts of the world. And so it's very, very valuable opportunity to learn. Of course, as a member of Veterans for Peace going there, and also particularly a member of Climate Crisis and Militarism Project, although the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom are the ones that sent me there, and thank God for them because they really are on the move. I am so proud of the work that they've been doing at COP. But there's a lot of overlap between what CCMP is doing and what WILF is doing in terms of military impacts on climate. So that's part of what took me there. But to kind of get back to the idea of understanding how COP works, we all understand that this year at COP, for the first time in history, we've got an oil executive from the United Arab Emirates, the CEO of Abu Dhabi National Oil Company, ADNOC, also in a major conflict of interest, heading up COP as the president. Well, that alone outraged people all over the world. And ever since that was announced, there were people that were calling for him to step down. Inevitably, he didn't step down. Inevitably, he was there. As crazy as this sounds, I think the tremendous overreach by the fossil fuel interests and the petrostates, in this case, particularly the UAE, really served to benefit our movement because it was very clear throughout the whole 2 weeks that what he was doing was not really in our best interest, right? He's not there to phase out fossil fuels. So he was sold to the public at large and to the COP entities based on his role as the head of UAE's renewable energy company, as an environmentalist. You know, well, yeah, he did that, but his heart and soul and his paycheck is all coming from the oil industry. So right away, when COP started, there was skepticism. You could feel it in the audience, on people's faces. There wasn't a lot of enthusiasm. They were really reserved about this guy. He was on trial. And right away, the BBC leaked documents that revealed that ADNOC expected Al-Jubeir to do their business deals while he was there, particularly with China and some other nations. Well, Al-Jubeir said no. He had a special conference to deny all that. But the next thing that happened is Al-Jubeir, in a videotaped conference with some attendees on Zoom, said that he didn't think that science called for a phase out of fossil fuels to meet climate objectives. Whoa, that's a major wake-up call. So he was being really looked at very, very skeptically. And the good thing about this reached the media worldwide. Because we all know, if you're paying attention to climate, fossil fuels and their impacts on the climate is why COP was formed in the first place.
You're listening to Veterans for Peace activist Cindy Peister.
And then before the 2 weeks was out, OPEC sent a memo out to all the OPEC nations saying, don't sign any final documents that even use words fossil fuels. Well, that got leaked to the media too. In the course of 30 years, there's never been a final document at COP that used those words, fossil fuels. People were outraged. Everybody was very angry with him. And there was tremendous pressure on Al-Jaber and the leadership of COP28 to go ahead and use those words. So ultimately, what happened is they did put out a final document that said they were going to transition off fossil fuels, and OPEC nations signed it. I don't think that would ever have happened, honestly, if people were not just so absolutely outraged. Of course, the delegates had to stay up into the wee hours to get that accomplished, but it was accomplished, and it's not enough. It's not nearly enough. It isn't phasing out fossil fuels with a timeline, but people are on alert. The other thing is there are more than 2,400 fossil fuel lobbyists at COP. The true purpose, I think, of Al-Jaber being there was to give the appearance of climate mitigation, but with absolutely no plans with any teeth in them to phase out fossil fuels. And science, climate change, was mentioned repeatedly at COP28, but the final decisions did not really reflect it. For example, the IPCC has said that 2025 had to be the year of highest emissions, with every year after that reducing them, or we wouldn't meet the 1.5. There was no language in there on that. And the island nations were really distraught about that because, of course, they're right on the front lines. But what COP did this year is it really showed what was going on with the fossil fuel industry. The other aspect of this that I think is really important here is, if you remember when I was on your show last year, I talked about the negotiations being trench warfare. The Egyptian COP president, Sami Shoukry, who came across as if he was a good guy and going to mitigate climate, in the last minutes showed his true nature and his true purpose in being there, and he refused to include language in phasing out fossil fuels, which was just outrageous. And then the one reason I was really very, very glad that we were able to meet later than earlier in terms of COP is that just this week, as Jim, you already know, COP's next engagement will be held in Azerbaijan. And who they have chosen there to be their COP president is Mukhtar Babayev. And he is being sold to us again on the model of Al-Jaber. He's being sold to us as Azerbaijan's ecological and natural resources ministry. Al-Jaber was sold to us on the basis of his role with Mazdaq, the UAE's renewable energy company. So it's like a game plan, I think. And I think it's probably been going on for years to prepare particular people for these roles. And not only that, but the state oil company of Azerbaijan Republic, that's called SOCAR, that country, Azerbaijan, has relied on gas and oil for more than 92% of their export revenue. They did that last year. And so I'm not at all expecting anything from Babayev in terms of really doing something that will call fossil fuels into question. But the good thing about that is that all of us delegates are waking up. We understand what the playbook is. And I really want to go back in time here about the role of the United States in COP. I think that when we look at COP and their failure, that we really need to remember what we're dealing with here. Edward Snowden's documents revealed that the U.S. had spied on Indonesia at the Bali Climate Summit in 2007. He also revealed that the U.S. National Security Agency, the NSA, was spying on governments at the Copenhagen Climate Summit before and after it was held in 2009, with the purpose being that to inform U.S. climate negotiators of what the other countries were doing so that they could be better prepared for those negotiations. Angela Merkel, the president of Germany, was one of the people they spied on, and she was outraged. And then WikiLeaks made public in 2010 that they had U.S. diplomatic cables, which also showed this, the CIA, not just the NSA, had sought intelligence from U.N. diplomats about the negotiations in advance of the summit. So then I also would like us, if you please bear with me on this, recall the role of the American Petroleum Institute and ExxonMobil and how they knowingly spent decades working to undermine the validity of climate science that they knew from their own experiments to be true. And I actually have those research papers. They were willing to risk human extinction in the process rather than chance a loss of profits. To my view, this is the biggest crime against humanity ever perpetrated. It was a successful thing that they did going on some 40 years. And millions are already dying because James Hansen's climate warnings given to Congress in 1988 were ignored. American Petroleum and Exxon said would be the measure of their success was when the average American would walk around and say, well, you know, the client science really, it isn't really for sure, you know, having instilling doubt when it was for sure. And we all can remember that that was what's been going on for years now, that, oh, we don't really understand climate change to be true. I also want us to remember particularly that over these last decades, what we have seen continually is wars for oil and oil for wars, Iraq and Afghanistan, wars based on lies that we've been given. Well, in truth, we went in there to get control of the oil, and just countless people in Iraq and Afghanistan have died. And both of those countries terribly impacted by climate change. We also need to recall that in the last few decades, U.S. presidents have either denied climate change or have tried to position themselves as climate leaders while putting the U.S. in the lead in terms of fossil fuel production. And here we are again, right? This last year, the U.S. is definitely the hugest producer of fossil fuels in the world. We already know that on a per capita basis, the U.S. is most responsible for emissions, and that our military and war have tremendous impacts on the climate, with the U.S. Military being the largest institutional emitter of fossil fuels emissions, and all of the finances that pay for this with the DOD budget are diverting money that we need for climate into military operations. So I know that we really want positives about what COP can do. But just like when you're going into a war, you really want to know the truth of what that whole story is. And I think that what happened at COP this year really helped us to get a grasp of that.
You know, I know last year, one of the questions we asked is, did this year's COP actually recognize military emissions?
Oh, that's a really good question, too. Okay, so you remember at COP27, probably, that I was able to directly speak to the U.S. State Department on this specific issue and talk to them about the Women's International League's stance on that and VFP and CCMP's stance on that. We were calling for is that these emissions be included in our nationally determined contributions, that there be clear and transparent transparent reporting of all emissions, military emissions, war-related emissions, that the UNFCCC actually change and update their protocols for how these emissions are reported. Because what happened, you know, in 1997 during the Kyoto protocols under the Clinton administration, sadly, was that the U.S. government leaned very hard on the UNFCCC to be sure that these emissions were not in the loop, that they were not mandatorily reported. So to answer your question, no, they were not. However, there's been absolutely tremendous movement on this issue at COP, with a number of side events held at COP that were very powerful and excellent by the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, with Nita Crawford from the Cost of War Project, and also Deborah Burton from Tipping Point North South, calling for these issues to be addressed. And also Deborah Burton calling for the IPCC to do a dedicated evaluation on military emissions and give us that report very soon. They were asked directly about doing that, the IPCC was, and they said no. They said they've got two pages of different things that they need to make special reports on. And so they aren't interested in that. But we know that that's absolutely critical because they're 5.5% of the global whole. And we're not going to be able to make progress until that is done. But we are building very much on that work within the confines of COP. And one of the chants that are being used and also called out at the different discussions is the need for peace for climate justice. And that's really a step forward because it's getting the word out. At COP27, there was a call put forward to have a dedicated peace day at COP. And it happened this year. There was a theme day related to peace and health that was put forth on a single day. And so even though that was a theme day and not an official day, it opened the door for these side events and these conversations. Another thing that's opened the door to these conversations comes through Ukraine. For the very first time in history, we're able to get scientists on the ground during the bombardment from Russia and actually measure the impacts of war-related emissions on Ukraine. And the first 12 months of that war, they came up with a figure of 120 million CO2 equivalent emissions, which is nothing to sneeze about. It did include the costs of the emissions cost of rebuilding. So it's a little elevated in that sense. But that very same concern now is being elevated as we think about Gaza. So the military's on notice. NATO is on notice. The U.S. DOD is on notice that civil society has had it, that we do want military emissions to be properly tracked, recorded, and reported. If they go into a war and destroy an area like Gaza's being destroyed, there's going to be an effort to get reparations for that. That's why Ukraine was there. They want reparations from Russia for the destruction that was done to their forests, their infrastructure, their water, everything. And even though it wasn't done this year, and even though the IPCC isn't moving on this, there's been a tremendous effort by various actors calling for that. So they aren't going to be able to keep this on the shelf forever.
It sounds to me like you're saying the biggest accomplishment from this COP was the number of people that got pissed off.
Well, and the degree of being upset, the fact that media worldwide covered these issues. Al Jaber's comments that the climate science didn't support phasing out fossil fuels was outrageous. That he was the CEO of an oil company, that OPEC was saying, don't sign this. That kind of thing really had people paying very close attention, much closer than they would have otherwise, to what was going on at COP and calling it out. Also, I would like to say, from just watching these plenaries and the actions that I saw there, it looked to me like there was tremendous efforts to more or less stage what was happening at COP. For example, they had a plenary on youth. The youth were talking. Now, all of us here talking today know that the youth are the faction of the public that are most outraged by climate change, because they're the ones that are going to have to deal with the fact that climate emissions are what they are, and they're the ones that are going to be stuck with the worst impacts. But at this particular plenary that I was looking at, there was like five or six people up there. The two main speakers were officially related to the UAE, one of them being a young person, one of them being one of the partners of Al Jaber, and they would field the questions. So it was a press conference. Journalists there were asking various questions, and they specifically called on these two youth that were not part of UAE. Their answers were rather tepid, in comparison with what we would expect, or I would have expected, or what I think the journalists expected. And one of the young women there that spoke, she said that they had been prepared for 5 months by the UAE for their role at COP28. What does that mean? Just looked staged. Yeah. And there were other things, like, you know, during the plenaries, when people were speaking and representing their countries, it looked like they got cut off. They got reminded they had 3 minutes, or the people after them got reminded they have 3 minutes, in some really crucial timing.
Omar brought up that Gaza was actually brought up during the session.
Oh, absolutely. You know, just as the Ukraine war had a big impact on COP on 27, and also this year, because they came back to talk again about war emissions, what was going on in Gaza was just on everyone's mind, absolutely everyone's mind. There were a number of heads of state in the plenaries that spoke out about Gaza, and we don't really have time to go over all of them, but Iran's delegation left the summit in protest at Israel's presence, according to Iranian media. And President Erdogan of Turkey called Israel's war on Gaza a war crime. And he said that with recent developments, we realize the importance of establishing the independent sovereign state of Palestine in accordance with the 1967 borders. King Abdullah of Jordan spoke out very strongly. Colombia's president spoke out. There were other nations that spoke out and had strong feelings. The president of Iraq supported the Palestinians, but the biggest support that we saw at COP, I think, came from the actual delegations, but it was on everyone's mind.
Well, that's just the way everything is right now. No matter what the subject, Gaza comes up, because it's all connected.
Yeah, so, absolutely. You
know, with everything terrible.
Yeah, and you know, the person that did the determinations, that was head of the scientific team on the ground in Ukraine, his name is Leonard de Klerk, and he did that because he felt he had the scientific capabilities, he had the friends that understood how to do that, and he thought that it would help the Ukrainian people to get those numbers, because people could relate to the fact that the climate impacts from these wars was going to affect everybody, where if it was just the war and the Ukrainians being killed off, it might not affect them the same amount. So in conversations that I've had both with Wilf and also with CCMP, I was actually able to do email exchange with de Klerk. He's already on this issue of the emissions in Gaza. And one of our members at Climate the climate group at VFP, Climate Crisis and Militarism Project, is trying to figure that out. I was trying to figure it out, but I was trying to do it during COP, and I didn't want to miss COP, so I've put it to the side. But there is science available to figure those things out. People want to know, and efforts are being made.
Well, we have to leave it there, but we are clearly not done, and so we are going to share Part 2, Cindy Peister, a Veterans for Peace activist, and Dr. Omar Clay, a ecological educator, next week as they move from the specifics of COP to the damage in Gaza and the U.S. complicity in it all. With that, we are going to finish this show like we did last year with a great song from friend of the show, Janet Bates. So here is Canary in the Coal Mine.
A canary is in a coal mine, and the air is getting tight. She knows if she could fly away, she would be just fine. They keep her in a cage a half a mile into the mine. And when she stops singing, they hope they'll make it out in time. Too far for him to swim, and any fool can see what a predicament he's in. Above the waterline, just a little closer to the ocean all the time. Is no one else concerned about what makes the water rise? Could it be they believe that they'll make it out in time? Find. And he's getting mighty hungry, and he's getting mighty dry. The only land that's arable is shrinking all the time. The Africaner's farm is all he can see on the line. Should the moon awake to find her wings no longer white, the way the story goes, we'll never know.